Welcome to the Iowa Blog. I am your host, Craig Wynn. I want to speak to you today from the heart about something that is essential to the survival of the hostages, the survival of Israel, and even the redemption of God's people. On the 8th of October of last year, the morning, actually, after the savage Islamic attack on Israel on 10/7, which, of course, has been blamed on Hamas, and yes, they were culpable, but Hamas terrorists represented a tiny percentage of those who stormed into Israel to terrorize, rape, torture, abduct, and murder Jews, celebrating the occasion not only while they were doing such things in Israel, but when they returned to Gaza. The overwhelming majority of the perpetrators were just ordinary Gazan Muslims. And so the enemy that attacked Israel, the one that you are combating, cannot be eliminated by going to war in Gaza. They cannot be eliminated by defeating Hamas. There is no remedy in eliminating Hezbollah. And if you were to root out all of the PLO elements and Islamic Jihad from the West Bank, it would make very little difference. This is because all of these organizations are symptoms of the bigger problem. It is not well known, but it should be, because it is exceedingly well documented that when Muhammad left what was actually Petra, not Mecca, in shame, and got some 20 pagans from Yathrib, the original name of the town now known as Medina, to follow him, he did so by getting them to pledge to wage war against all mankind. It's the Pledge of Aqaba. It begins the Islamic era. And immediately thereafter, Muhammad began to attack the most vulnerable prey: Jews. There were three Jewish tribes in Yathrib. They represented about 75% of the population. It was the largest Jewish population in Arabia. But by the time of Muhammad's death, they were all dead. Muhammad systematically expelled them, robbed them, and then he terrorized them and murdered them. Muhammad and the first Muslims raped the women, enslaved the children, and decapitated the men. Genocide is something that Muslims have been perpetrating against Jews for 1,400 years. That Israel is your enemy. You may wish to deny it, but it is undeniable. And it has been true for a very long time. So now, after 10/7, Aska Flood, as the terrorist act was called, has left such a scar on the nation of Israel and on the Jewish people, you have nothing but bad choices. There are no good ones. But I'm going to share with you the best alternative that exists to right some of the wrong that was done on that day. Because Israel, if you capitulate to these terrorists and you meet their demands, if you withdraw from the Philadelphia corridor and allow them to resupply, if you trade them convicted terrorists and murderers for the innocent men and women they abducted, all you're going to do is make the situation far worse. History has proven this to be true, and yet I know that 70% of Israelis want to do a deal with the devil, no matter how bad that deal is, no matter how much Israel has to capitulate. But here's the simple truth. If you again trade innocent hostages that were kidnapped by Muslims for convicted Islamic terrorists, all you will get is the certainty that you will make thousands and maybe even millions next time, Jews vulnerable to being kidnapped, tortured, abused, raped, and killed. They did these things knowing that this would be your response. Don't fall for it. Yes, I know it's sad. There probably are 25 living hostages still being abused by these Muslim savages. It breaks my heart to know that's true. But you are not going to prevail should you trade with these savages and you go down to their level. On the morning of 10/8 of last year, I told Israel exactly what the nation had to do if you wanted to get the hostages back now and not kill anyone in the process. And the answer is still the same. You need to trade Al-Aqsa Mosque. And if that does not prevail after you have raised it, the Dome of the Rock. And if that does not prevail, the Kaaba. That is what needs to be done. You want to have Islam taught a lesson by Israel for having perpetrated genocide against you for 1,400 years, this is the way. Now, I'm going to share with you the history of how Al-Aqsa Mosque came to be, because it is a horrible embarrassment, not only for Israel, but even worse for Muslims. And so I'm going to tell you what the press ought to be reporting, what academia ought to be teaching, what every Jew ought to know, and should be saying boldly to resolve this problem and to make it appropriate to remove those scars from the Temple Mount. But before I do, I want to scold the nation that I love. It is really inappropriate for you to parade around and wrap yourself in a flag that you say bears the Star of David. Now, the fact is, his name was Dod, not David. It means beloved. You don't know him very well because he did not have a star. That star comes from Bar Kokhba. He is the false Messiah that actually started Rabbinic Judaism based upon Rabbi Akiba's counterfeit. But for you to parade around, even in that name, while you allow the Temple Mount that he acquired to be scarred in this way with an Islamic trophy, says that you have no regard for him at all. It is the city of Dod. That mount belongs to Yahweh, your God, his God, my God, the only God. So for you to scurry around beneath it, while those scars remain, it's like poking a finger in God's eye. It is disregarding all that Dode represents and he has done for you. But I can tell you, if you had offered the survival of Al-Aqsa for the hostages, they probably would have said no, because they could not believe that you would have the guts to do what's right. But I would have followed that initial trade for another. If you don't believe me, within a week's time, I will destroy the Dome of the Rock, because its history is equally despicable. And if you don't believe me, the next to go will be the Kaaba. It, too, has a horrid history. But let's talk a little bit about how Al-Aqsa Mosque came to be, because it is a horrible insult to our intelligence, particularly that Muslims would go into Israel, flood into Israel under the name Al-Aqsa Flood, and massacre and torture, terrorize and abduct Jews. And Jews would be clueless as to the history of that shrine that was motivating them. But here's the story. And everything I'm going to share with you is documented chapter and verse in the books bearing the title Goddamn Religion. Now, for those that say, how dare you take our Lord's name in vain? God is not Yahweh's name. The Lord is Satan. And God damns religion. You can go, if you wish to read the five volumes of Goddamn Religion, to goddamnreligion.org. They're all presented there in your entirety. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I want to educate you. I want to enlighten you. I want to liberate you. I want to protect you. Go to goddamnreligion.org. You'll also find these books at yadaya.com. And what you will find is that they represent the most comprehensive, chronological, contextual, and accurate portrayal of Muhammad and of his creation of the Quran and of Islam. Those books are comprised in their entirety of five sources. The Quran, of which every verse of every surah is cited. The Hadith of Ibn Ishaq, which is the Sirah, was the first written book in the Islamic era. It depicts the life of Muhammad. And then there is Ibn Ishaq's Tariq, which is the history of Islam's formation. It is the next oldest book comprised in Islam. And both of those accounts, while both are chronological, unlike the Quran, which is a jumbled mess, were retained and passed along the same way as the Quran, from lip to ear, for generations upon generations before they were finally written down. The message in those three texts is the same. The players were all the same. The places were the same. The terrorist acts were all the same. I also cite from Muslim and Bukhari's collection of hadith, as they're arranged in a topical arrangement. What I did for Goddamn Religion, so that you have evidence that everything I'm telling you is precisely accurate, is I took the Quran and reordered it chronologically and set it into the context of Muhammad's despicable life by using the topical arrangement of hadith. And let's be clear. Without these hadith, Islam does not exist. the religion and all of the things that we are witnessing on behalf of the religion are the result of those hadith collections, which convey Muhammad's words and his deeds. They are the legacy of Muhammad. This is what I learned and what you will learn should you read those five volumes. And they are not short. They average 825 pages apiece. Muhammad engaged in what's called the never-ending argument. Those who knew him best all rejected him. They called him demon-possessed. They called him a madman. They called him a liar. They said that he was not only making all of this up, that he was regurgitating the lore of other religions, and that nothing that he was conveying was original or accurate. And in this never-ending argument, which is the single most prevalent theme in the Quran, repeated some 1,000 times, all of those who experienced Muhammad firsthand knew what I am telling you, that he was a liar, that he was a violent, demon-possessed individual, something he himself admitted. Muhammad was a sociopath. He was a rapist. He was a pedophile. He was a mass murderer. He was a thief. He was a slave trader. He was a womanizer. He was a horrible man. And there is no other conclusion that can be drawn by those with any degree of morality that read the Quran and Hadith, or as it's all laid out for you in chronological order, and goddamn religion. So as a result of this never-ending argument, Muhammad ultimately got frustrated. And so did his own tribesmen. And so what they did is he had become such a nuisance, such a threat to them, that after Muhammad wore his act thin, and those who knew him best mocked him, Muhammad threatened to slaughter them. And so the response of his kin was the same as we witness around the world, and unfortunately by too many Jews today. They tried to appease him. They told Muhammad what's called the idolatrous indulgence. They offered him money, which he craved, prestige, which he craved even more, and sex, perverted sex, if he would acknowledge the gods and goddesses of the Kaaba. You see, Allah wasn't one of the gods of the Kaaba. Oh, the gods of the Kaaba, Alat, Aluza, Manat. And so Muhammad accepted the deal. He said, all right, I will accept your gods and goddesses. I will acknowledge them. I will incorporate them into my new religion for this promise of sex, power, and money. Huh. And people went wild and said, oh, wow, isn't this going to be a lovely situation? We've resolved the problem with a little bribe. Well, it didn't work out well. You see, at the time, Muhammad, around 70, was diddling a six-year-old girl. I call that pedophilia. And this young child was the daughter of not only his best friend, but the only stalwart supporter he had, Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr didn't get any of the money. He didn't get to wear the crown for a day. He wasn't offered perverted sex. And so he went to Muhammad and said, wait a minute, pal. You told us this was a monotheistic religion. And here now, you're incorporating these goddesses. Because Muhammad actually recited a Quran surah that acknowledged that Alat, Manat, and Al-Uzza were goddesses. And so Muhammad loved his, well, lusted for his little plaything, Aisha, the six-year-old child. And so he renounced the very agreement that he had accepted. But the way that he renounced it was horrific. He said, yeah, I said these things. But all of Allah's messengers speak on behalf of Satan. He blames Satan for his acceptance of the idolatrous indulgence and for including the Kaaba's goddesses into his Quran recitals. Well, he went from the frying pan into the fire. And so Muhammad now was a laughingstock. In fact, according to the hadith, there were only a handful of Muslims at this point. He had preached for 12 years. He had spoken about his great claim to being the messenger of, well, it was originally the Lord, and then it was Ar-Rahman. And finally, he settled upon Allah, although Allah has a variety of different names. Allahu, Allahat, Allahi. And he was so embarrassed that after these 12 years in what was likely Petra, a town of thousands of people, he had 5 followers. So he needed to get out of town. He needed new digs. He needed a change of scenery. So that night, as Muhammad went to bed with Aisha, he dreamt that a donk mule, a barak, scurried into his tent, nudged him a little bit with the hoof, and said, "Hey, Mo, let's go for a ride." He jumped aboard the flying donk mule. And where did he go? He flew the donk mule to Jerusalem. And what happened there? Well, he entered the temple and he met with all of the big shots of the so-called Bible. Yeah. Adam, Noach, Dode, Moshe, Solomon. He even met with Isis. Isis, by the way, is a transliteration of Esau, the person that Yahweh said that he hated. But Muhammad wasn't very bright and not very good with names. And of course, there was this little problem on the night's journey, which is, by the way, also included in the Quran. There was no temple. The Romans destroyed it in 70 CE, centuries before Muhammad was born. There was no temple. Oh, well, got also a little issue that asses don't fly. And of course, everybody that he claims to have met with was long dead. But it gets worse. How could it get worse, you say? Because then once Muhammad had this big powwow, he actually claims that he led all the Jews in a series of prostration prayers, that he wanted to go and visit the mighty Allah. I guess the only way to get to Allah is through Jerusalem. Well, that doesn't speak well of the Kaaba, does it? And guess what? He jumped aboard the flying ass again. And the first stop on the way to Allah, hell. Yeah. Right above Jerusalem, hell. And when he went to hell, there are two things that were important for him to share. The first is, according to Muhammad, hell is filled with women. And they're all found hanging from their breasts with meat hooks. Yeah, it's true. It's what the hadith says. And Muhammad claims that he asked, why are these women hanging from their breasts with meat hooks? It's because they didn't appreciate their husbands. Misogynistic, you think? Now, of course, he didn't ask to free them. He didn't ask to annul their pain. He just wanted to know why they were there. And of course, one of the women that he stumbled into there was his adopted son's wife, who he lusted over and used his encounter there to steal his adopted son's wife in an act of incest. Yeah, this was one upstanding dude for sure. Well, leaving heaven behind, Muhammad hightails it through these various climbs up to what he calls the seventh heaven, meeting with dead Jews along the way, having lively conversations with them. And he reaches Allah in the seventh heaven. And rather than say, hey, Allah, how about some enlightenment? Why don't you share a prophecy to give this Quran a kick? A little proof, perhaps. Show me a miracle. Roll over, since you're a rock god. Do something. Nope. He said, met Allah, and all Allah wanted was to be prostrated to, butt up, nose down in the dirt 50 times a day. Huh. Now contrast that with the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, who doesn't even ask us to pray to him. And every time somebody gets on their knees, he asks them to stand up. But nonetheless, that's what his pal Allah wanted. Anyway, he leaves. He's all disheartened. He comes back flying the donk mule, of course. And he wakes up the next morning. And he's got children, of course, in his bed. And he tells them, this is what happened to me last night. And even the six-year-old, who may have been nine at the time, tells him, if you tell that story to the people, they're going to mock you. That's insane. It didn't happen. You never left this bed. But Muhammad didn't really care about facts. That wasn't his thing. So he went out and told everyone who would listen about his night's journey to the non-existent temple, meeting with the non-existent individuals. What a horrible embarrassment. And that is why Al-Aqsa Mosque, which he claimed in the Quran that he went to visit long before it existed, is there. It is a complete and utter embarrassment to Islam. And because of the effect of this, Muhammad was literally laughed out of town. They shoot him away. And on the way out of town is when he met with the thugs from Yathrib, these pagans, whom he told the same story that the Meccans had heard so many times about the impending doom, but the never-ending argument always ended the same way. Well, if you don't agree with my guy, who's really not demon-possessed, he's really not mad, he's really not making this up, then Allah will torture you in hell. He will pour boiling water down your throats. He will burn you on a rotisserie to the point that your skin singes off. And then he's going to give you a new skin because your torture will never end. Of course, that puts Allah in hell. And it puts people in bodies. And it condemns to eternal torture those who mock a man who admitted that he was demon-possessed. But nonetheless, Allah was very accommodating of his boy. And so when Muhammad left, he told the same story to the pagans from Yathrib and said, if you go kill for me, if you steal for me, you'll get to keep 80% of what you steal. I get to keep 20. And on top of that, special bonus, if you're killed, there's a special brothel in paradise for you with virgins, both boys and girls, to satiate your carnal desires. Yes. Allah was a God who thought it was appropriate to reward rape, and torture, the slave trade, and mass murder, even thievery, with multiple virgins. It's pretty sick, isn't it? Nonetheless, the 20 pagans agreed to the Pledge of Aqaba. This is the first year of the Islamic era because nothing in Islam prior to that mattered. The first year of the Islamic era is the Pledge of Aqaba. It states, we promise, we pledge to wage war against all mankind. And they began with the Jews. That is the story of Al-Aqsa Mosque. And if you want to get your hostages back, you hold it hostage. You tell the world the truth about it. Go read Goddamn Religion. You'll find it at yadayah.com and at goddamnreligion.org. It's all free. All five volumes, 825 pages each. Overwhelming and undeniable proof that everything I have shared with you is true. Hold it hostage. Yes, the world will scream. They're already screaming at you. What would be different? Oh, but we would curtail any chance of more Abraham Accords with the Saudis. The only way the Saudis are going to do a deal with Israel is for Israel to capitulate on the Fakistinians, to give the heart of Israel to the very terrorists who have sought to annihilate you for the last 1,400 years. That's not much of a deal. And oh, by the way, you need to know the story of Hudaybiyah so that you understand the nature of doing a deal with Muslims. Muhammad, after he had wiped out all but one tribe in Yathrib, went down to the Kaaba in Petra, not in Mecca. Mecca didn't even exist at the time. And we know it was in Petra because the Qibla is the direction of prayer of every early mosque points to Petra. Petra is the only place where the geography matches the descriptions found in the Hadith and the Quran. The Quran never once mentions Mecca. It does mention the Bekaa Valley, but the Bekaa Valley is literally the house of the Lord. It's in Lebanon. It's where one of the largest Roman temples in antiquity was built. And so he went and he wanted to do his circumambulation thing around the Kaaba. And he gets close, and his kin says, you know, you left town pledging to kill us. Ever since you've left, you've done nothing but kidnap our sons and daughters, rape our children, rob our caravans, and murder us. We really don't want you in town. But if you want to come, here's the deal. We know you're a fraud. You know you're a fraud. Renounce Allah. Renounce the Quran. Renounce Islam. And pledge that you will not harm any one of us again for 10 years. And we'll let you come. Well, you see, Muhammad got cold feet. He knew that the last time he was in Mecca, that he was so badly mocked that he lost all of his followers. And for him to go in with this ragtag group, underarmed, He faced the same situation. So he got cold feet. And he signed the agreement called the Agreement of the Treaty of Hudabaya, which is where it was signed. Renounced everything. Chronicled throughout the Hadith. But then the Muslims who were with him, they were promised the normal routine. We'll go in, we'll kill the men, we'll rape the women, we'll enslave the children, and we'll confiscate everything of value. And that's the deal. What do you mean? We're not going to terrorize them. What do you mean, no booty? What do you mean we're going back? And they turned on him. So what did Muhammad do? On the way back, the Jews he had exiled to rob them of their homes and their businesses, their date farms in Yathrib, had gone to Kabar, another farming community. On the way back to town to satiate the carnal desires of the first Muslims, they went directly to Kabar, where they laid siege. It's where the phrase Allahu Akbar was first spoken. Allahu Akbar means Allah is greater than Yahweh, the God of the Jews. It's an insult. Well, they laid siege. And when they prevailed, because the citizens, the Jews of Kabar, had nothing but farm implements, and the Muslims were wielding swords and arrows and lances, the win was over. The men were not just killed, they were tortured to death. Once again, the women were raped, with Muhammad getting first choice of who he would rape. The children were enslaved. Everything was stolen. Muhammad and the first Muslims had perpetrated genocide against the Jews. And then against the Arabs, his own people. The following year, he amassed a far larger militant force, and they went and conquered Kaabaville. His word wasn't worth anything. He would lie. He would renounce his God and his Quran for an advantage. Muslims do deals when they're in an inferior position, and then they renounce them when the person or nation that they have convinced to accept their terms relaxes and becomes easier prey. This two-state solution that will be required to do a deal with Saudi Arabia will be just such an affair. The Muslims will promise peace. And once Israel is vulnerable and indefensible, the next attack will be at least 100-fold what you experienced on 10/7. Now, I don't say this because I've just studied the history and I know what's going to occur. I've read the prophets. I know precisely what they say is going to happen and exactly when it is going to happen. And so I'm telling you, this is what you do as a nation, collectively as a people. But I'm not speaking to all of you. I'm speaking to those who have an interest in knowing Yahweh, who have a backbone, who have a sense of judgment, whose eyes are not blind, who are not deaf, who are willing to come to know the creator God of the universe. His name is Yahweh. To re-engage in his covenant, to attend his Moed Mekre as he intended. I'm speaking to you. Because if you do these things, Yahweh will respect you. And he will protect you. And you have very, very little time left to earn his respect. And so if I were you, I would begin by holding those three buildings collectively hostage. You release ours, or we take yours. This has been the Yahweh Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn.